United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Toth and Judge Lahrer. And we're pleased to be hearing oral argument at the University of Iowa College of Law in Iowa City, Iowa today. And we're here for the matter of Larry D. Edwards versus Dennis McDonough. Docket number 20-7244. Counsel, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Joshua Leach.
Brian Anderson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Leach and Mr. Anderson. And secretary's counsel?
Alex Catroli, joined by Deputy Chief Counsel Matt Haddock.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Catroli and Ms. Haddock. And as you know, each party has 30 minutes to present their arguments. Mr. Leach, do you want to reserve a portion of your time?
I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, great. We will make that happen. And you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. The issue here is the board's August 2020 denial of entitlement to service connection for a cervical neck injury. For the purposes of this argument, I will focus on the regulation 38 CFR 20.202F and the board's requirement to clarify appellant's review options for the notice of disagreement appeal to the board under the Appeals Modernization Act, which I'll refer to as the AMA. I wanted to start by mentioning that 20.202B provides three options for an appellant appealing a denial from the board, or sorry, a denial to the board. There's a direct review option, and that option does not include the submission of additional evidence. There's a board hearing option, and then there's another option, which is an opportunity to submit additional evidence without a board hearing with the notice of disagreement and within 90 days afterwards. Now, the facts of this case that are that appellant submitted a November 2019 notice of disagreement. On the form itself, he selected the direct review option. He checked a box on the form that said he was attaching additional sheets, and attached to that notice of disagreement was a detailed lay statement that provided new evidence that wasn't previously in the file, including details about his injury in service, about the continuity of his symptoms since his injury in service, and about what his VA physician told him about the nature of his injury. None of these details were present in prior evidence that was before the RO at the time of their rating decision. Now, under the direct review, under the regulations the Secretary has promulgated, when an appellant selects a direct review option, the board is only to consider evidence at the time of the RO decision. So if under direct review, that statement submitted after the RO decision cannot be considered by the board. Now, 20.202F states that when the board receives an AMA NOD and cannot identify which review option the claimant intends to select, the board will contact the claimant to request clarification of the claimant's intent. So the situation here is that we have an NOD. He's checked the direct review option. He's checked a box saying he's submitted additional pages, and attached is new evidence that the board can't consider under the direct review option. And this raises an ambiguity, which is what this court addressed in the prior case of Evans v. Shinseki in 2011. Now, that was a legacy appeals case, so the AMA came into effect in February 2019.
But counsel, what's the ambiguity? I mean, 20.202F is pretty clear that the board has to at least seek clarification, and they didn't.
Your Honor, so the ambiguity is that if you look at the form itself, under the direct review option and under the evidence submission option, it doesn't tell him that any evidence submitted with that form cannot be considered by the board. And in fact, the evidence submission option, and I'll look right at the form, and this is the form, VA form 10182, direct review request. For evidence submission, the form states, I have additional evidence in support of my appeal that I will provide within the next 90 days. That doesn't tell the veteran that if he attaches a statement that's evidence, that it can't be considered under the direct review option. And the direct review option also says I will not submit any additional evidence.
But if I can slow you down, I mean, if you look at, I don't know if you've got the reg in front of you, but if you look at 202C1, right, and you look at that last sentence, I mean, I think there's maybe two ways you could read that. So the sentence goes, the board will not consider evidence as described in rules 302 or 303 unless the claimant requests a board hearing or an opportunity to submit additional evidence on the notice of disagreement, right? And so I think, so maybe one reading is that a claimant could submit additional evidence and the board simply has no obligation whatsoever to read it or consider it. Another reading maybe is that a claimant can submit additional evidence. Maybe there's a duty to read it, but only if they have the claimant basically fill out a correct NOD in advance so that all parties sort of understand what lane they're in and how the procedures are going to work. Right? I mean, do you have, I mean, is there a way that you think we should read that?
So what I would read it as, is basically, so this goes back to, I think, 20.301, which is directly addresses the direct review. And it's actually that regulation that states it's based on the record at the time of the agency decision. And then, Your Honor, that's why I believe the regulation 20.202F is put in there, because there is an ambiguity as to what to do when a veteran submits evidence with the NOD. It's clear that the direct review is telling the veteran he's not submitting evidence after the NOD, but the veteran didn't do that here. He submitted his evidence with the NOD, and the board in its decision did not address this ambiguity. And the board, in fact, on page 6 of its decision specifically stated that it was considering the evidence in front of the RO at the time of its denial, which would preclude that statement. Confusingly, the board then on page 8 actually listed the statement out when it's reciting the facts, but then the board provided essentially a paragraph of analysis denying the claim that didn't address any of those specific facts. So the board decision is ambiguous in and of itself, and I think maybe the board is confused here too as to what it should do, but it didn't apply 20.202F. And if it had done so and contacted the claimant, the evidence submission lane directly provides in the regulation that you can submit evidence with the NOD in the regulation. So he could have chosen that lane, and it would have gone back to the board with that evidence, and he could have had that evidence considered in his appeal. And so I think the overall problem here is the ambiguity that the board didn't address. This is comparable to...
Again, I mean, maybe I'm hung up on the term ambiguity. I mean, I think there's a couple ways. I think we can recognize the board obviously didn't follow the procedure on 20.202F. I mean, I think that's a relatively non-controversial proposition. So what does that mean? I mean, I think you brought sort of a constitutional argument that would impaired due process. I think another way to look at it is, it could call into question the finding in the board opinion that the veteran actually did choose the direct review lane, when obviously there's actions that maybe that's not a plausible finding in light of the whole record. What do we make of, let's stipulate that that's an error. I mean, what do we make of that? How do we characterize that error?
So that error, I believe, would be a reasons or bases error, and that's because the board didn't make a factual finding here. The board, what we would say the error is that the board needs to make that factual finding first. It needs to be remanded for the board to apply 20.202F and make that factual finding, contact the claimant, make that factual finding as to what the claimant intended to select. And the due process was because it's you know, depriving him of his notice that his evidence wasn't going to be considered. And that's also what I wanted to get to.
So so you're, in your argument, you linked up the due process argument with the 20.202F argument as though, like, they were intertwined. Now you seem, right, from what you said just now, you seem to be unlinking them.
Yes, Your Honor, the due process, we believe that is sort that this case can be remanded separate from the due process, finding that the due process was violated, and that would be the most straightforward basis, that 20.202F was not applied. And I wanted to address Evans because Evans, even though it dealt with the legacy system and the VA Form 9, it's the facts are similar in that case, so the appellant selected on the prior VA Form 9, he selected, I want to appeal all the issues. And then there's also an option, which is 9B on the form, that says I only want to appeal select issues and then a box to list the issues. So the appellant in that case selected that he wanted to appeal all the issues, but he listed the specific issues in the box. And the court actually found in that case that that created an ambiguity, but the court found that VA had a duty to apply, and there was a statute in effect at that time, and that was 20.101D at that time, and that required the board to seek clarification when a substantive appeal is ambiguous. So the court found that even though the appellant in that case created the ambiguity there by selecting an option and filling in the wrong box, the court found that the secretary had promulgated this regulation and it had to apply it to this case. The court also found that that VA needs to look beyond the four corners of the document itself to the entire record. And in this case, so he selects the direct review option, he checks the box that says I'm submitting additional sheets. Now, notably, unlike the Form 9, there's no explanation box, big explanation box directly tied, but there is an option to attach sheets. So that is, you know, an additional document, but it's actually part of that NOD because he checked that box. And so under the principles established by Evans, VA should be following its regulation that it promulgated and clarifying an ambiguity here, even where the appellant may have created that ambiguity.
But so what's the harm? I mean, it appears the board did consider some of the evidence. So what did it not consider? I mean, or let's say this. I mean, if it, let's say it recognized that you know, it appears that the veterans chosen the evidence lane, and then we have a duty to consider this evidence. What discrete piece of evidence did it not consider?
So Your Honor, the harm is that, so on page 6, the board states it's limiting its consideration to the evidence before the RO, so that doesn't include that statement. The board then listed in the recitation of facts, but it's unclear from the board decision since it said on page 6 it was only considering evidence before that denial that it was actually considering that evidence. So in the board decision, and it doesn't list the evidence in its analysis portion of the decision, which is only one paragraph, and it's a very cursory sort of analysis, it appears from the decision from the board statement that it's not actually using that evidence as probative evidence in support of appellant's claim. And so here's where the evidence is different than what was previously in the file. So appellant in September 2019 filed a claim. On it, he only listed that the neck injury was due to a military vehicle accident in service. And now the only other statement he made was to the VA examiner, and he told the VA examiner that he had been treating with a chiropractor. He also told the VA examiner that his neck, he had had neck problems since service. The detail in the statement with the November 2019 NOD, I wanted to mention a couple points in that NOD that show the additional detail. So first, the main thing is that he stated that he was advised by his VA physician that the injury appears to be very old due to the amount of arthritis that was formed around the injury area of his neck. And this is page 21 of the record. This is a statement that's not in the medical records. It's not in his the prior brief lay statements. And that statement alone, if the board considered and addressed it, could substantiate the claim, because under 3.309 for arthritis, you can establish service connection with the continuity of symptomatology absent a nexus opinion. So that right there is prejudicial. But he also states that he did not have any other injuries over the years that would have resulted in harm to the neck. That's not in the record. That's new evidence. And had an adequate VA examiner addressed that statement, he would have to resolve the fact that the veteran is competently stating he hasn't received an injury that could have affected his neck, could have caused this since the military service. So appellant was harmed because the board decision on page 6 clearly states that it's considering the evidence in front of the RO, which precludes this statement. While the board goes on to list the statement, the board doesn't actually analyze the statement and apply it to the facts of the case, address the adequacy of the medical opinion, and so forth.
Now, I believe in your brief, you were referencing Robinson and Zamraj and a few other cases that talk about sympathetically reading a veteran's pleadings. Was Mr. Edwards represented at the time that he completed that form?
Your Honor, he was not represented by an attorney. He was represented by a veteran service officer with the American Legion,
which the court considers to be unrepresented.
Correct. And I think this court in Comer specifically stated that a VSO doesn't have the legal training of an attorney.
And so, but if you're arguing a 20.202F violation and that the board should have applied this reg, but it didn't, it didn't mention this issue at all of extra evidence submission with the NOD, and even potentially a request for additional record development with the NOD. Do we need the sympathetic reading case law? How is that relevant here if this is just a simple 20.202F violation?
Your Honor, I think it's relevant because the court in Evans specifically noted that it was relevant. And it's relevant because we're sympathetic. We're interpreting a veteran's claim in a favorable light. So what we're interpreting here is that he wanted this evidence that he submitted with the NOD. He wanted that considered in his appeal. And that's a favorable interpretation that he would have wanted that evidence considered. And I think the court in Evans states that claims are to be adjudicated in a non-adversarial manner, a veteran-friendly manner, and that's kind of the uniqueness of the veterans law system. And that's why I highlighted in the brief Robinson, because mm-hmm. all of
but,
this.
But the language here of F is, if the board receives an NOD completed on the form prescribed by the secretary, but the board cannot identify which denied issue the claimant wants to appeal or which option the claimant intends to select, the board will then contact the claimant to request clarification of the claimant's intent. So, I mean, you insist that we would need the sympathetic reading case law in order to say that 20.202F applies here?
Your Honor, I would say that you don't necessarily need a sympathetic reading there to apply that statute. I think that, you know,
That regulation.
I think that, you know, it's helpful, which is what I wanted to point out in the brief, is it's helpful to always point out that these things should be sympathetically read.
But, and does the sympathetic reading case law, let me phrase it another way, is a sympathetic reading principle, is it necessarily grounded in the duty to assist, or is it a standalone? Can it stand on its own without regard to the duty to assist?
You're right. I think reading the case law, it can stand alone without regard to the duty to assist, because we're just talking about, you know, any type of claim that's submitted where it might, you know, for example, if a claimant were to write, you know, I want this specific diagnosis of his neck, that's regularly read to encompass all possible subsequent diagnoses.
Okay, and the duty to assist, did it apply at the time that he completed this form, or did it stop applying when he received the, when the RO issued its initial decision?
So, Your Honor, and this is Regulation 20.802A, the correction of a duty to assist error under the AMA applies to errors that predate the decision on appeal. So that would be a pre-decisional duty to assist error. I did want to highlight the second sentence of 20.802A. The second sentence states that the board may remand for correction of any other error by the AOJ in satisfying a regulatory or statutory duty if correction of that error would have a reasonable possibility of aiding in substantiating the appellant's claim. So a plain reading of that regulation would not preclude the board where it sees it as necessary to correct a duty to assist error post-decision from correcting it. So the standard duty to assist as we think of it applies pre-decisionally, but there's also some leeway in this sentence in the regulation for the board to correct a duty to assist error if it would aid the claimant in substantiating the claim. And I see I'm running short on time, Your Honor, if I may briefly conclude unless there's any further questions.
Counsel, I just want to make sure with respect to that reading of the reg that you're talking about, duty to assist both with respect to the records, the motor vehicle accident, and the treatment received from the chiropractor, as well as the adequacy of the CMP exam that you raised in your brief and
yes.
reply.
I see my time has expired.
Yeah, Ms. Brickhead, please add another 3 minutes.
Okay. So we're alleging in the brief duty to assist errors as to the military police file, as to the private treatment records from the chiropractor, and as to the adequacy of the medical opinion that the VA examiner provided. And the chiropractor records were mentioned to the VA examiner, so that's a pre-decisional error. And the VA examination, the VA examiner's failure to consider appellant's statements at the time of the examination before the RO is also a pre-decisional duty to assist error. If there are no further questions,
With respect to CMP exam, I think what you're talking about is the statement that the veteran gave during the course of that exam as to continuing pain and treatment.
Yes.
And it is included in the record. However, the examiner did not weigh the favorable evidence with the unfavorable in reaching the conclusion that the first mention was when the veteran filed the claim in 2019. Is that your position?
So our position is the examiner's opinion is inadequate because it did not consider his statements to the examiner. And so the examiner used a lack of medical evidence of treatment in those intervening years for the foundation for the negative nexus. However, the examiner didn't address it. He actually stated he did receive chiropractic treatment over the years for that condition. So that was a pre-decisional duty to assist error on the part of the examiner. So I think in conclusion, I just want to point out the overarching fact of this case is that 20.202F is a regulation for the board to clarify an ambiguous notice of disagreement, and the board failed to apply that regulation here. Thank you.
Just a clarification here, Mr. Lee. Are you dropping the due process?
We're not dropping the due process claim, Your Honor. We wanted to highlight in this argument the more straightforward basis for the court. We do feel there is a due process error here because he was not notified that that evidence he submitted would not be considered before the administrative decision on appeal.
So in your rebuttal time, and I'll try to be quick, I want to ask you a bit about credibility and the role, your argument about the board discussing credibility. We can do so in the rebuttal period.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. I'd be happy to discuss that in the rebuttal, and I see my
time is up. Thank you, Mr. Leach. Mr. Cotrola, you may move ahead.
May it please the Court. Chief Judge Bartley, Your Honors. My name is Alex Cotrola, and I'm joined alongside by Deputy Chief of Counsel Amanda Haddock, and we represent the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. In this case, appellant is asking this Court to make broad sweeping pronouncements that frustrate the purpose of the AMA and will replicate the inefficiencies and delays that plague the legacy system. This Court should decline for three reasons. First, this case falls squarely within 20.202, which plainly states that the board will not accept a board review request in any format other than that on the standard form NOD. Second, the board was not required to seek clarification under 20.202 because appellant's NOD was clear on his face that he elected the direct review option, and he confirmed this choice months later. Third, the duty assist no longer applies to the board, and the board was statutorily barred from considering extra record evidence to find a pre-decisional duty assist error.
So your second argument is basically a harmless error argument, which is fair enough. They treated it de facto like a evidence submission. They considered the evidence, so there's no harm.
Are you referring to our brief, Your Honor?
You said your second argument. Is basically that the board had no duty to seek clarification because they considered the evidence, the relevant evidence, right? Am I misunderstanding your argument?
No, Your Honor. Our argument is that the board was not required to seek clarification in the 20.202F because the NOD was clear on its face. If we look at the NOD on page 20, there is one and only option selected on that form, and according to the regulations, the review option must be on the NOD form itself, the 10182 form that is issued with the AOJ decisions. In fact, when Congress enacted the AMA, it also made amendments to 70105 that require appellants to initiate an appeal via the standard form NOD that is issued by the Secretary, and also authorize the Secretary to create requirements that would constitute an adequate NOD. Some of those requirements are what kind of information must be in the form, including the direct review option. And in the form, the Secretary has three very clearly laid out options, one of which, as appellant's counsel has noted, appellant did select, and he has already conceded that appellant was at least on notice of the different review options as provided by the AOJ decision and notice of further review rights that he received prior to making the election. The form itself also says...
Okay, I'm a little confused now. So you're obviously he checks the direct review box, right? But then he submits, in addition to that, a statement... Right. Did the statement come later, or was it alongside the Form 10, the 10-182?
The statement was attached to the 10-182 or standard form NOD form, Your Honor.
And so, is it your argument that if a person checks a box, it doesn't matter how much evidence they submit, that itself is not an ambiguity merely because they clearly checked a box? Am I misunderstanding that?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. We believe the standard rule that should apply for NODs is prescribed by Congress and effectuated by the Secretary's regulation. Congress did mandate that appellants complete a standard form NOD in order to trigger an appeal to the board, and as part of those requirements, select one of the review options.
Your argument is basically the four corners of that form are the only thing that you should consider in determining whether there's an ambiguity?
There are probably exceptional cases, Your Honor, that might allow for the consideration of additional form of with the NOD to potentially trigger clarification in the 20.202F. But we must look at the regulation itself, which says unless the claimant requests, 20.202C, Your Honor, unless the claimant requests a board hearing or an opportunity to submit additional evidence on the NOD, 20.202 says the board will not consider the evidence. And in this case, as appellant's counsel has repeatedly noted through his argument, the intention of the NOD was to constitute as evidence, which would, in essence, conjure up a checkbox on the form that does not exist. But the regulation specifies that even if a claimant wants to modify a choice that's already listed on a clear form, they must submit another form. That is as something you alluded to earlier, Judge Choth, that it helps clarify the process for everyone, the board and the veteran alike, because the board cannot cannot docket the case and provide the substantive and procedural duties as required, for example, a hearing, unless it knows what option the veteran selected. But this is consistent with 7105 and 7113A through C, Your Honor, which three times in reference to 7113, three times states that the request for a hearing must be on the NOD. And while we note that appellant did check the box on the form that says I am submitting additional forms, that checkbox is intended for identification of additional issues, which is not the issue in this case. There is only one issue in this case, and that was service connection for the neck injury. We do not dispute that that is the issue before the court, and that the NOD otherwise is an adequate NOD. And there's nothing on the face of this form that indicates that appellant wanted a different review option. If appellant, for example, had stated on the form, check two boxes, check three boxes, check no boxes, and submit the NOD, that would probably be a scenario, Your Honor, where the board would be required to request clarification. And that would most certainly be a clear evidence of ambiguity.
So in this case, if the veteran, instead of attaching a sheet with no caption on it, if he had written, please consider this evidence, I want this evidence considered by the board in the direct review lane, and he attached the sheet that we have at record at page 21, the RBA at 21, 20 and 21, and attached that to the NOD. That you're saying that situation, that didn't happen here. This situation is a little muddier, I guess, because he didn't have like a cover sheet saying, hey, here's new evidence. I want the board in the direct review lane to consider this. If he had done that, are you saying that because he didn't write it on the face of the NOD, that there would be no need for the board to clarify what lane he was choosing?
I think the facts of that case are different, as you noted, Your Honor. In that scenario, it's possible that the board would have been required because of the potential ambiguity created by appellant's description on the form, stating, I'm selecting the board review lane, but also simultaneously submitting additional evidence. However, 7113 specifies, it states that evidence cannot be considered if it is outside of the, at least in the board review docket, if it is outside of that election. For purposes of the regulation, it can be considered, but only if it's unclear, Your Honor. And in that scenario that you posited, that would potentially create an ambiguity that would have required clarification.
But the board did consider the evidence here.
That's correct, Your Honor. The board did consider the evidence. It noted that this was a direct review case, and that's also simultaneously considered that evidence. So we would agree that there was no prejudice to appellant in this case, particularly because appellant now or after the board decision or after this court's decision comes out can file a supplemental claim. And even after appellant received this notice of the docketing letter, he had an opportunity to modify the election then. In appellant's brief at page 8, he states that had he known that the board review lane would not allow for consideration of this additional evidence, he wouldn't have considered it. But he hasn't contested that he received notice.
But didn't he say that he would have chosen a different lane had he understood that the board direct review lane did not allow new evidence?
I believe that potentially goes to the due process argument, Your Honor. But part of an element of due process is whether someone was adequately informed. In this case, appellant did receive notice of how the AMA dockets work. The form itself also identifies how the dockets work, as do the instructions. Appellant received notice multiple times before he actually selected his option on the form how the AMA process works. To this day, appellant contends that the duty to assist applies to the board after the AOJ decision, but that is just simply not true. That is contrary to the law.
So he doesn't understand the lanes. That's basically what you just said. He doesn't. You told him. You wrote him like 3 letters, but he doesn't understand it. Is that what you're saying? An unrepresented veteran didn't understand what the technical language that the board, or the VA, included in its letters.
The problem with hindsight, Your Honor, is that we can't go back in time and know exactly what appellant was thinking. It's easier to look back. Hindsight's always 20/20, is the saying. But in this case, appellant did confirm, at least on his after the docketing letter came out, that he did want direct review. To the extent that appellant did not know and still does not know how the AMA system works, he is not prejudiced. He can still file a supplemental claim and have this very same evidence that he's seeking to have considered now, considered by the AOJ. In fact, he had the option of having that same evidence considered by the AOJ without appealing to the board. In fact, he had 3 different appeal options that would have allowed for consideration of the additional evidence. He had a supplemental claim lane after the AOJ decision. He also had the evidence submission lane and the hearing lane before the board, neither of which were chosen. And at least the latter two were on the form itself.
But he's arguing that there's been a violation of 20.202F. I think Judge Lauer has a question or questions for you as well, but I just want to nail this down. I want to be clear about this. Your statement, I thought, your argument is that if the veteran had written something on the 10-182 form that created an ambiguity or an unclarity, that would have been okay. Then 20.202F would apply. But that because he attached a separate sheet and that attachment created the ambiguity or unclarity, that takes it out of 20.202F? It sounded to me like that was what you were arguing earlier. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe so. I believe, if I may clarify my point, we don't believe that the additional attachment creates any ambiguity at all. The only potential ambiguity that is created would be appellant's request for additional assistance by having the records located. But the duty to assist doesn't apply regardless of the lane that appellant chose. And if you look at the rest of the attachment, it only contains additional evidence. However, the board cannot determine whether a form, whether it be an attachment submitted with the NOD or thereafter, constitutes new evidence unless it pre-adjudicates the appeal to be able to notify appellant. That would require extensive amount of cross-referencing by the board and extensive amount of work, and it will also require...
But, I mean, there is case law. Like, I know the case Shea, right, deals with when you have a pleading, right, and it has to be filed on this form 10-182, if they submit medical records, for instance, that reasonably identify a condition noted in the pleading, you know, under our case law, they have to consider that. So obviously there are things that go beyond the four corners of the document that are taken into account in terms of assessing the scope of the pleading. I don't see why they would not also be relevant to assessing what lane, procedural lane the claimant wants to adjudicate the case.
I guess to be clear, Your Honor, our position is not entirely that evidence considered outside of the submitted with the NOD but not on the form cannot ever be considered. There are presumably circumstances when that might apply.
Well, I mean,
but
Shea says you have to consider some evidence. I mean, if there's a medical record that's relevant, you would have to consider it as part of the pleading. So your point is you could consider it for some evidentiary value, but not, it's completely irrelevant to determining which lane the veteran chose.
It is what Congress intended through the statutes that it enacted, Your Honor.
I mean, how? Like this, this goes against, so many areas of law. Like even in a contract, right? If you agree to contractual language and then you immediately do something that's completely antithetical to the terms that you know, it suggests that you don't understand the actual. It suggests an ambiguity in the claim, in the intent of the parties and sort of entering into the agreement. I don't see how submitting a statement couldn't be deemed to call into question the fact that the claimant chose the direct review lane and did not want any evidence considered. He's obviously submitting evidence.
If the court was to adopt the rule that appellant seeks in this case, Your Honor, it would circumvent the whole purpose of the NOD form, of it being required and it being required to state the review election on the form.
But how? I mean, your own regulation says, listen, there's three lanes. It can be unclear. And that's a very simple requirement of just to reach out to the veteran and clarify. That's not a hugely inefficient process.
There are other provisions within the regulation, Your Honor, that must be looked at in order to create a harmonious reading with respect to 20.202F. As previously mentioned, C says that the claimant may only modify the information in the form by submitting a new NOD. That did not happen in this case. In addition, 20.703, which applies pertains to requests for hearing, states that any request for a hearing that is not made on the NOD form will be rejected. That regulation is...
But they consider the evidence. I mean, the VA's own actions show that they're not ascribing to the reading that you're making here. So, I mean, even if under some estoppel principle, we could say, okay, well, you started to consider the evidence. Now you have a duty to kind of consider all of it. I mean, that might apply. But I'm struggling to kind of get there. I mean, I thought you'd argue harm. And maybe that's really what you want to make the kind of crux of your argument. I'm just surprised. I mean, this is kind of an aggressive place legally to sort of to make this challenge, and I'm a bit surprised by that.
If I may, Your Honor, mm-hmm. Congress enacted the AMA to streamline the appeals process because of the decades of backlog, the years of backlog that were being created under the legacy system, and due to the numerous complexities of the...
Yeah, no, but it's not... I'm sorry, I don't mean to get on you, but, like, repeal your own regulation. It's not... We're not dealing with a statutory duty here. It's your own regulation that's requiring you to seek clarification.
The regulation does state, though, Your Honor, only if the board determines that it's unclear. The board determined that it was clear in this case. On page 6, the board stated that this was a direct review appeal, and according to the and it determined what the appeal lane was and what the evidentiary cutoff window was.
So the consideration of that evidence is just like a gratuitous favor to the veteran. Like, okay, you chose a direct review, we have no obligation, but, you know, since you brought it up, we'll discuss some of the evidence.
That does go to our lack of prejudice argument, Your Honor, that the board did consider the additional evidence and therefore there was no harm. But the board is statutory barred from considering the additional evidence. So, you know, we would agree that the consideration of the evidence constitutes legal error, to which the court can determine whether that legal error constitutes prejudice or not by reviewing it under a harmless error analysis. But so that aspect, Your Honor, we do believe that the appellant was not harmed. In terms of the regulation, we believe that the board did comply with its own regulations because it did determine that it was clear. Although appellant did submit additional evidence, as previously noted, the board could not have determined that unless it looked at all the evidence that was previously considered, all the statements that are previously noted, the descriptions of the injuries, the descriptions of the time and place of the injuries, the symptoms, who the veteran saw or who was in the accident, all sorts of different descriptions, Your Honor, that the board would have to log and then compare and contrast with the additional statement to determine whether something constituted new and relevant evidence in this case. The burden and not only on the board but also on the system, Your Honor, it would essentially recreate the legacy system by creating the same backlog because appellants are allowed to submit argument with their appeals, and as a matter, I apologize.
I wanted to ask. This is more. Well, this is a completely different area of question, but this is kind of a systemic question, just to help me understand. So if in a process of a hearing, say somebody chooses the hearing lane, and then they during their testimony identify very accurately a record or something, there's no duty at all. I mean, the duty assist. I mean, simply, basically, almost the board can ignore that.
During the hearing, Your Honor?
Yeah, I mean, say he had said, listen, on this date in 1975 at Fort Knox, I was in this accident, and here's the custodian of that record, and the board would still have no duty to go hunt down that record.
That's correct, Your Honor. The secretary is only implementing Congress's statutes and the will of Congress, and Congress spoke and stated that the duty assist no longer applies to the board. The board acts as an appellate body now, it can only correct duty assist errors that occurred prior to the AOJ decision on appeal. Therefore, even if the board could have considered this additional evidence, which was statutorily barred from doing, it could not have remanded for a duty assist error because the evidence that appellant is relying on to constitute that error came after the AOJ decision.
They could have just called him and then explained it to him, and then he might have chosen the evidence submission lane. And that would have helped him, right? Because then they could have gone and maybe gotten the military police records or the base accident records or the chiropractor records or one of the all of the many things that he mentioned in his attachment to the 10-182. If he were in the evidence submission lane.
That would require a lot of effort on the board, Your Honor, for the reasons that previously mentioned, because the board would not be able to determine whether the evidence that was submitted in the NOD was new evidence unless it pre-adjudicated the appeal to make that finding. And multiplied across, I believe last year, the board decided 120,000 appeals. Multiplied across a system of that magnitude, simple rules are required in order to more clearly understand for veterans and also more efficiently adjudicate appeals
so
as the board is required to do.
So is it the board member would say, you know, that's a really important record. You should file a supplemental claim, and then you can, you know, that's something you can re-raise with the AOJ tomorrow, and they'll hunt down that record for you. Is that the idea that you remove the duty to assist and then the supplemental claim piece sort of fills that gap? You just sort of lose the effective date that you would have had before.
That's correct, Your Honor. The appellant could have simply submitted a supplemental claim. He could have withdrawn his appeal to the board, could have modified his review option before the board decision in this case. I believe the board decision was issued 11 months after his initial election in this case. An appellant was within his rights to have modified that election, and according to the regulations, that election would have required a new NOD. It could not have simply been a statement stating, I would like to move my appeal now into the evidence submission lane. Although the Secretary is simply implementing, effectuating the intent of Congress by streamlining the appeals process, Your Honor, which benefits veterans and the board, some of the benefits that one of the harms that come with requesting clarification, Your Honor, under 20.202F, it's stated in 20.202G that if the appellant does not respond, timely respond to that request for clarification, his appeal will be dismissed. So it's not, although it's easy to sort of think about it in this context, but there are certainly going to be appellants that the board potentially does request for clarification from that will have their appeals dismissed as a result of failing to clarify their election. And that that dismissal is authorized by the Secretary under 7105, which states that a failure to submit a proper NOD will result in the AOD decision becoming final. And therefore, it's not a light task simply to ask for clarification in all scenarios, because there will inevitably be appellants that are harmed by the clarification request itself. But in addition, Your Honor, the modification process by itself would be superfluous if an appellant, which requires the submission of a new NOD, would become superfluous if an appellant could simply submit a statement stating, I would like to move into a different lane. Because it multiplied across the entire spectrum, Your Honor, it would potentially create the board misinterpreting different statements by the veteran. Sometimes there are a host of documents that are submitted after an election. For example, I had a case 2 weeks ago where there was 8,000 new pages submitted between an appellant's board direct review docket selection and the actual board decision. If the board was required to sit there and parse out every single detail within those documents to determine what is new and whether any piece of any component within those documents could potentially cloud the issue of what review so option
in that
intended.
Case was that were they submitted at the same time, or was it, you know, because I can see there's sort of a sequencing issue of, you know, the board's ready to issue a decision, and then all of a sudden, an hour before, you get a submission of evidence, right? But, I mean, were they contemporaneous in that case?
I don't recall, Your Honor, but given the vast number of records that were submitted, a number of them were definitely submitted outside of the NOD process. But to be clear, I apologize.
You may finish for Judge Toth.
I was just going to say, we firmly believe that the NOD attachment submitted in this case does not constitute any ambiguity, because it would be no different than if appellant had simply submitted a medical opinion from a doctor stating, I believe, for example, his neck condition is due to service. According to the statute, that evidence cannot be considered pursuant to Congress's intent, not the Secretary's intent, Your Honor.
Run that. Which statute?
7113, Your Honor. A through C lists out all the different board review options, including the direct review option, and states that evidence cannot be considered outside of the board direct review lane if the appellant does not request the evidence submission lane on the NOD. And this is also consistent with other regulations, Your Honor, 20.302 and 303, which also specify that a request for a hearing and or evidence submission lane must be on the NOD. But we don't need to look at specifically just nail it down to the regulation. Again, we don't believe that the NOD attachment creates any ambiguity, because it does not say, for example, in any clear terms, I would like a hearing, or I would like to submit additional evidence. In fact, most of the attachment appears to be additional evidence and statements related to some of the other things that were already previously reported.
But additional evidence and statements related to something that was already submitted, wouldn't that nevertheless be considered evidence or not?
No, Your Honor. According to this court's decision in Avias Rivera, the statute bars the board from considering that additional evidence. Oh,
right, I know, because I wrote Avias Rivera, but but that there was not a situation where the veteran submitted an NOD that was and an attachment that seemed unclear. One check mark chose one lane, and the attachment appeared to be directed towards another lane. I mean, that was not the situation in Avias Rivera. So
that's correct, Your Honor. The facts are not identical, but in that case, the appellant was trying to loop back a board remand that stated that the examiner must consider any NAS updates for purposes of rendering an opinion, and appellant had argued that open-ended instruction essentially allowed additional evidence to come in after the fact. But as this court noted, 7104 and 70, I am out of time, Your Honor.
Would you add another 5 minutes, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. And in that case, Your Honor, the court found that 7104 and 7113 operate together to prohibit the consideration of additional evidence because 7104 does not operate as a loophole.
It's tough. Yeah. I mean, this is technical, but obviously, this is not a jurisdictional rule. It's a claims processing rule, right? Which is the board does not have an obligation to consider evidence. It's not Congress saying the board is acting in an ultra vires fashion when it does consider evidence, and that's basically the difference between a jurisdictional rule and a claims processing rule. Claims processing rules are waivable. So when the board considers the evidence, I mean, just by their actions, it's deemed that they've in effect waived. I mean, claims processing rule, like if somebody submits something late, like 3 weeks late or something, it gives the board the authority to dismiss something, but it doesn't deprive the board of the legal authority to hear the issue if it were properly before it, right? And so I asked the opposing counsel, I mean, there's sort of two ways to read that provision. One is, like, I think the way you do, is an absolute, you know, the board lacks any authority to hear this. The other is the board can consider it, but a condition precedent for considering it is that they get the veteran to sort of sign off on the new NOD or fill out a new NOD so everybody sort of knows what the sequence is going to be. Can you speak to any of that? I'm just having a hard time finding, you're arguing this is sort of quasi-jurisdictional, like the board lacks the authority, and I'm just not buying it.
I don't know if I have a firm position on whether it's a claims processing rule or jurisdictional rule, Your Honor. From what I understand, and I'm happy to provide supplemental remarks after the argument on this issue, but from what's specified in 7105 and 7113 and the way the statutes and regulations work together, indicate that the board is barred from considering evidence outside of a chosen window, evidentiary docket
but then,
window.
So the error of the board would be considering evidence that lacked legal authority to consider. That would actually be the board error in this case, because it obviously did consider the evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was a legal error for the board to consider that evidence. And 7104, along with 28.801, state that the board actually has no obligation to, should not consider that additional evidence because it's outside of an evidentiary window, but it does have an obligation to tell the appellant that the evidence was not considered and how to go about having that additional evidence considered. In this case, appellant still has the right to file a supplemental claim, as previously mentioned, and have the additional evidence considered because of the board's sort of impermissible consideration of that evidence. And so he is not prejudiced to the extent that the rules and the statutes bar the consideration of this additional evidence. And he also was not prejudiced by the delay, Your Honor. As part of his arguments here, appellant is asking essentially for the court to remand to the board, which would trigger a remand to the AOJ for a duty to desist error. That process in and of itself is longer than the process that it would have taken appellant to have submitted this additional evidence to the AOJ and had a decision issued that that would have considered the additional evidence.
Maybe, but we're trying to, at least I'm trying to, I'm not sure where the other judges are, but I'm trying to figure out what does 20.202F mean. And so right now it sounds like you're saying that 20F doesn't apply here because we don't think this NOD was unclear, but I haven't gotten a clear answer on why it wasn't unclear whenever he chose one lane. And yet he submitted evidence which is only allowed in another lane.
Actually, at the risk of replowing ground that we've gone through, I mean, looking at the 10-182 form, part two you start off where it tells the person applying that you can check only one. In this case, the veteran checks 11A, direct review, which states, I don't want a board, and then says, quoting, and I will not submit any additional evidence in support of my appeal, and yet this is forwarded with a cover letter that doesn't say I'm forwarding my 10-182. It provides very specific details to include the VA doctor who allegedly told the veteran that these appear to be from an old injury, et cetera. So it's a very detailed cover letter. And so my question is, and you went through and you talked about the Secretary implementing Congress's intent with streamlining under the AMA, and we understand that, but it kind of leaves me with the question of then what is the protection that the Secretary intended? I mean, I get it. You're saying that it is clear, and obviously we can – reasonable minds can differ. The reasonable person could look at this and certainly say this is unclear because you've checked, I'm not going to present anything else. But yet you included as a package. So my question is, what doesn't that eviscerate the protection under 2202F, where it says, if the board cannot decide what the claimant intends to select, then the board will contact the claimant to request clarification of the claimant's intent. I'm hard pressed to think of an example of how that would protect. Outside of sort of this, what we're looking at, what the court's considering here. And so, it seems to eviscerate the protection that the Secretary has afforded veterans under this provision of the regulation.
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor. We do believe that 20.22F does exist to protect veterans' rights, and there are certainly clear examples of when that regulation would come into play. For example, if appellant was to have submitted both the evidence and the direct submission lane, had submitted some clear statement on the form or even in the attachment to the form stating, I want a hearing, I want to submit additional evidence. There is no clear statement or request to submit additional evidence in this case. All we have is a form that simply contains additional words that obviously after the fact of that submission were determined to be evidence. The board could not have known appellant's intent at the time that he submitted the NOD because it's not reflected on the NOD form, nor did appellant submit any sort of request on the NOD form that would sort of obscure the clear choice that he had made on the form. In essence, to create ambiguity where we have a clear choice on the form, we would need an equally clear choice or request on the form. In this case, all we have is a statement that describes additional details of the incidents, the injuries, the symptoms, and so on and so forth. That, to the board, especially at the docketing level, Your Honor, the board could not have known what appellant's intent was and could not have known whether it was additional evidence unless it pre-adjudicated that appeal right then and there. Which would have required significant effort on the board and create the undue delays that that Congress sought to eliminate by enacting the AMA. We believe that while there will certainly be examples where appellants do submit evidence outside of their chosen window, they're still not they're not prejudiced because Congress did provide opportunities, fail-safes, if you will, for the consideration of that additional evidence. As long as they submit that additional evidence through a supplemental claim or seek to modify their election, they can have that additional evidence considered and protect the effective date of their initial claim, which is one of the benefits of also having a simple rule that primarily relies on the four corners of the document, because for purposes of setting effective dates, assuming a claim is granted, it doesn't muddy the waters in terms of whether someone did or did not appeal something. Also, because we're in unprecedented times with an unprecedented number of claims, unprecedented of size of files and complexity of issues, appellants have numerous issue appeals working at different times. Statements alone, without some sort of clear request, especially a clear request on the form prescribed by the secretary as mandated by Congress, do not evince a clear intent as prescribed by the forms. And therefore, we ask that if the court does issue a rule touching on this issue, that it does require that an equally clear choice on an attachment, for example, to the NOD be submitted with the NOD in order to create ambiguity. Otherwise, all we have is a clear election for a direct review lane. I see I'm almost out
thank
of time,
you,
Your
Mr.
Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Cotrolli. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Leach, you may move ahead with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to first address, so the Secretary's counsel said that if you would assume, and we don't think that the board actually considered this evidence if you read page 6, but if you do assume they considered it, the Secretary says he can then just file a supplemental claim with this evidence and preserve his effective date. Well, he can't do that, actually, because that evidence is now not new and relevant. It's been part of a final agency board adjudication. So he would have to come up with separate evidence to file that supplemental claim and preserve that effective date. So we do believe that even if you assume that the board considered this, there is harm here. And I wanted to address some of the secretary's arguments. I think the secretary failed to address here is that nowhere did anywhere on the form or the docketing letter inform appellant that evidence submitted with the notice of disagreement couldn't be considered in the direct review lane. That docketing letter that he referenced, that just told him that he could change his lanes if he hasn't yet submitted evidence. It didn't tell him what it was going to do with the evidence it had already submitted. And that's why, you know, that's – I think the secretary just failed to kind of – address why the VA here isn't required to follow its own regulation that it promulgated, which is 20.202F. And, you know, as Your Honors noted, if this is not the type of situation where 20.202F it applies, I'm not sure what that situation would be. If there's not ambiguity here, I'm not sure what the situation would be where there would be ambiguity, when you have an option selected on a form that precludes the evidence that is attached to that form from being submitted. To assume that there was no ambiguity, you would have to assume that the appellant attached evidence and didn't want that evidence considered in his appeal. It wanted the board to, despite the submission of evidence, just decide the claim on the prior evidence in the file to get a quicker decision. And in fact, if the appellant had just had been given the choice to select evidence submission, that would not have – he would likely have selected that because – I mean, we can't know, but he would likely have selected that because that would not add significant delay. It would just give him that evidence that he had submitted or 90 additional days to submit further evidence. So the fact that the board just didn't address 20.202F, didn't make any statement about, you know, why this wasn't ambiguous. The board didn't state that it wasn't ambiguous. I think appellant's counsel noted that the board stated there was a direct review appeal, but that was just the board sort of stating the option that was selected. The board didn't actually address that attachment and whether there was ambiguity created there. So that the board failed to make a factual finding there. I know, Judge Toth, you wanted to talk about appellant's credibility.
So you can do this quickly. Was the board required to make an adverse credibility determination here?
Yes, Your Honor, under Miller, if the board does not explicitly find the appellant not credible, that's considered an implicit finding that his statements are credible, because the court found that if something as important as the veteran's credibility were at issue, you would expect the board to make an explicit finding there. And that speaks to the duty to assist for that argument. The merits argument we made is that if the board does not find the statements not credible, the examiner actually has to address those specific statements, or the court will order a new examination. I know in his brief the secretary mentioned that the board made a credibility finding, but there's no explicit credibility finding. The board states, you know, that they mentions the gap in the treatment record. You know, of course, the board doesn't address that he had stated he had treated with the chiropractor, but the board was just weighing the evidence there. The board didn't explicitly or even really implicitly state the appellant wasn't credible here. In this case, I think, again, I just want to reiterate, if you look at that form, and I just wanted to pull this up again to sort of explain why would a veteran select a direct review lane and submit evidence? Well, if you look at this form, and that's page 22 of the record, that's the 10-182, it says direct review by a veteran's law judge. In brackets, it says choosing this option often results in the board issuing its decision most quickly. If you look at the evidence submission in the brackets, it says choosing this option may add delay to the issuance of a board decision. As a practical matter, you have veterans whose cases have been sitting there in the agency for years and maybe even decades, and they're explicitly told on this form that if you select this option, you're going to get a quicker decision. Now, the direct review doesn't state that if he attaches evidence there, it won't be considered, but it does sort of, you know, you can understand why a veteran would say, well, I want this reviewed by the board right away, so I'm going to check this direct review, and it gives me the option to attach something. So I'm going to attach my statement explaining why I think this is due to my neck condition is due to service. So I just wanted to highlight and sort of, you know, explain as a practical matter why you would have a veteran and why this would happen in cases where a veteran wants to get right to the board, but he also wants to include a statement there for the board to consider when it's deciding his case. And if there are no further questions, I'm happy to conclude here.
Thank you, Mr. Leach.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for your arguments. Before we submit the case for consideration, I want to thank the University of Iowa College of Law for being such gracious hosts over the last 2 days. And I wanted to especially recognize a few folks here. First, Dean Kevin Washburn. And this couldn't have happened without him. And also Jill DeYoung, Chief of Staff of the law school, and everyone who worked on security, and Pam Funk, Professor Andrew Course, Professor Amy Kretkowski, Professor Jason Rantanen, and I believe that is it. So we really do appreciate, of course, all of the attendees here at the oral argument, and without further ado, the case is submitted for consideration and the court is adjourned, and we will come down and greet counsel.